Hey, it's a pleasure to have really a wonderful group of scholars. I think Talmidei Chachamim and with an understanding of philosophy, and it's a pleasure to have Jimmy Diamond, I guess, a man of my own heart, who began his professional career as a lawyer, and then went into the field of Jewish studies, something I kind of admire. And he, of course, is today the Lubavitch Chair of Jewish Studies at the University of Waterloo. He's published at least two books on the Rambam, one of which won an award here in Canada, the Canadian Jewish Book Award. He's a top scholar, and he is proficient in many, many areas, and a friend of ours, and it's a pleasure to have Dr. Diamond to come and address us. He'll really be a continuation. He'll talk on Rav Kook and the Chalutzim, the inadequacy of halacha.
Thank you, Jay. I want to just begin with a couple of personal notes, just to cover myself. My expertise is not Rav Kook, so therefore, if you ask me questions afterwards and I don't know what I'm talking about, I always have that as a reason. My expertise has been more in the rationalist stream of Judaism, primarily represented by Maimonides, but others as well. Rav Kook was an entirely different experience for me. I've been living with Rav Kook for a while now, and working on him specifically in a project where I'm working on modern appropriations of Maimonides. So that is modern philosophers, Jewish thinkers in lots of traditions who, everybody wants to claim Maimonides as their own. You know, the old joke, there's Maimonides, your Maimonides, his Maimonides. And so many modern thinkers reinterpret, some would say distort, I don't like to use that word, or reinvent the Rambam. And Rav Kook is one of them. So there are a few scholars who have worked on Rav Kook's engagement with the Rambam. I think he engaged the Rambam throughout his life, even when he doesn't specifically mention him. Not unusual for any rabbinic scholar steeped in the Beis HaMedrash, in the yeshiva of the old world. Not unusual at all. But I think Rav Kook's take on the Rambam is quite unique. And of course, he cookizes the Rambam. So when I say I've lived with Rav Kook, one of the difficult facets of Rav Kook is his language. I don't believe, at least I haven't seen, there is much really translated into English. And there's a reason for that. I think there's one volume, there may be others, but there's one good volume of, kind of a scattered collection of his writings in English. But there is good reason for that. The language is extremely, extremely difficult. It is a modern Hebrew, but it is a modern Hebrew that is, of course, tinged with all kinds of other dimensions. That is, it's a modern Hebrew that's tinged with where he came from. He was, after all, an Elui in Volozhin. He was a beloved disciple of the Netziv. He was by no means a product of the modern world, the way we conceive it. And I might, maybe during this lecture, try to clear up a few misconceptions about Rav Kook. So the language is extremely difficult. It's modern Hebrew, but besides modern Hebrew, like I said, it's tinged with also medieval Hebrew, Talmudic Hebrew, but also what compounds the difficulty is the intensely personal element that is injected into his language. So that it is extremely, extremely difficult to decipher. The good thing about that is that everybody can claim they have a take on him because his language is so malleable. And it, of course, is in a modern mode in terms of its existential approach. So it's difficult from that point of view. It's also difficult, and again, by no means can I say I'm an expert, because you really, really have to be proficient in all the traditions that make up Judaism up until his time. That is the rabbinic tradition, the classic rabbinic tradition, the legal tradition that is poskim, and mysticism and Kabbalah. So his language is shot through with mystical notions, so that when he uses a word, it's nuanced by many, many layers of mysticism. And that, what I mean by that is Kabbalah has many, many stages, starting with the Zohar, and then Lurianic Kabbalah, and then Hasidic Kabbalah. And he was very influenced by all those, in particular, Chabad. That is, I had been doing some reading in Chabad theology, Chabad mysticism, and when you start reading Rav Kook, you see it very prominently. So from one side of his family, he actually had a tradition in Chabad. But he was very, very strongly influenced by Chabad, and I'll talk about what aspect of it, because it's very relevant to my topic. So that makes it very difficult, and I after spending a lot of time and writing on him, I'm starting to get scared that I'm digging myself too deep in this and I won't be able to get myself out of it, back to the rationalist tradition. It is very seductive. It is very, very seductive language. So going back to my point about the language, if he uses a word like hashpa'ah, now, many of you who are acquainted with Hebrew know what hashpa'ah is. Hashpa'ah in modern Hebrew means influence. But in Rav Kook's language, it takes on many, many, many other dimensions. There is a hashpa'ah that, when you read it in translations of Maimonides, let's say Guide of the Perplexed, is a completely different hashpa'ah, often in one of the classic translations, translated as an overflow. I hate that word, it reminds me of a washroom. But anyways, and it means something completely different than influence. And in Kabbalah it's used, shefa, in a completely different way. So a modern Hebrew speaker might think he understands Rav Kook, when he really doesn't understand him at all. Not in the least. He understands the word, like the word, but it has nothing to do with the modern word hashpa'ah. So that's what makes it very difficult. So what I'd like to do, I don't often do this, is I've written quite a bit now, and what I want to do is just start off with something I wrote, and I'll read it, just as an introduction to him, which might capture some of the difficulty I've had. Virtually all ideological strains and genres of Jewish thought which preceded him converge in the voluminous corpus of Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook's literary legacy. And of course, if you know the dates, he was born in 1865, he died in 1935. So well before the birth of the modern state, but of course one of the pillars upon which the modern state, perhaps maybe the modern state, could not have been established without Rav Kook. The elaborate complexity of his thought reflects the dizzying, biographical, and often tormented drama of his life, originating as a Talmudic Ilui in Volozhin, the most prestigious of Eastern European rabbinic academies, and through his passionate spiritual and political advocacy of Zionism, as a local rabbinic leader of the pre-state of Israel city Yafo, a stint as a pulpit rabbi in England, founder of his own independent political movement, Degel Yerushalayim, and ultimately as the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Palestine. Throughout this frenetic, communally activist career, his writing in various forms rarely ceased, leaving a prodigious record of his thought, driven by an irrepressible urge to disclose his most intimate reflections, no matter the consequences. And I quote here, "I must deliberate without any restraint, to pour onto paper without restraint all my heart's thought." This is relevant to the topic, where his thought transcends all rigid systematic boundaries that we're acquainted with, because it comes from the deepest, deepest dimensions of his being. Writing is both emotionally therapeutic And in its very realization, enlightening. For, quote again, at all times, precisely through it, are more sublime inventive thoughts articulated. These are my translations. Who knows? End quote. To be exposed to it is to experience an intense, intermittently frustrating struggle between temperaments that do not naturally exist harmoniously. As the poet, political activist, halachist, rationalist, and mystic within him vie with each other for spiritual expression. So that is, there is a struggle within himself because he encompasses all these different facets, a struggle that I rarely have seen, maybe never have seen, in somebody like the Rambam. So in some ways I can say he's a more complex human being. Again, that might be the wrong adjective to use. The linguistic freedom of poetry, the compromise demanded of politics, and the meta-halachic aspirations, that is, supra-halachic, beyond halacha, and visions of mysticism produce tension rather than agreement with the methodical rigor and logic of halacha and Talmudic reasoning. There is a constant tension within him between, as he calls it, ish halacha, well, not as he calls it, as Rav Soloveitchik calls it, ish halacha, or ish ha-Talmud, and ish ha-Agada. And I will say this as an assertion, that is, he felt himself much closer to the Ish Agada than he did the Ish Halakha. Now, let me preface this with a remark. I composed the title just to be a little bit seductive. Maybe get a bigger crowd. But also, I don't mean to say here that, Rav Kook was some reform rabbi or some flaming liberal or a pluralist in our secular kind of liberal democratic sense of the word. By no sense of that was he that. That is, he was, for all intents and purposes, I would say Haredi actually is a very good description of him. And even in terms of halakha, he was actually quite conservative in his halakha. In fact, in many issues, even more Haredi than the camp that he is said to oppose. I'm thinking here specifically of issues related to Shabbat. So for instance, when it came to milking cows on Shabbat, like how can you not milk cows on Shabbos? In the new yishuv, you're setting up kibbutzim, you're... Chazon Ish actually paskin that you can milk cows, and Rav Kook said, no, you can't milk cows on Shabbos. That's it. Shabbos is where I draw the line. Can't milk cows on Shabbos. You got to hire Goyim to do it. Okay, whatever. I don't want to get into that. I'm not a halachic expert. But scanning in a superficial way the way I did his halachic oeuvre, he was very conservative in his halachic positions. So when I speak here, I speak of his thought. Of what emerges from his thought. The tension, so there is a tension within his being between the rigor and the logic, the inner logic of halakha. I'm not saying halakha is logical to many people. It wouldn't be logical to somebody like Christopher Hitchens, I suppose. But it has an inner logic. That is, once you accept the basic premises upon which halakha is built, it has certainly a rigorous logic to it. Talmudic reasoning has a rigorous logic to it. But there is a tension between that and his spirituality. And I'll get to that in a minute. The tension mirrors itself in the very style of much of his work that takes shape more as a spiritual diary than formal treatises, working out some coherent halachic, theological, or for that matter, mystical theme. It is as much a record of internal struggle and spiritual turmoil as it is a systematic attempt to comprehend the world and man's place in it. However, that struggle does not merely constitute idiosyncratic personal knowledge, but elucidates a knowledge of the world systematically. It is both systematic, because he is a clear thinker. Let me just quote what he says. Ani tzarich ledaber harbeh odot atzmi. Who cares? Why would we want to listen to somebody speaking about himself? Sounds kind of egocentric. Sounds kind of selfish. Aspects of myself are bound to clarify much for me. When I understand, inyanei atzmiyuti muchachem litbarer li harbe ma'od, v'havanati et atzmi avin et hakol, et ha'olam ve'et ha'chayim, ad haga'at habina l'mekor ha'chayim. That is, because he saw himself as part and parcel of the all, and this is, I'll try to get into this a little bit, and the all is one, that is, we tend to see, and this is drawing on Kabbalistic notions, we tend to see the world in fragmented way. There's you. There's Dr. Judah sitting there, which I'm happy to see, listening to me. We're a bit worried, but we'll see after. There's Dr. Judah, there's Dr. Me. But in Rav Kook's world, we're all part of one unified existence that knows no division. So that when he knows himself, he knows the all. He's actually saying this, not from an egocentric point of view, but from his own philosophical, theological point of view. Although one must, quote, search the innermost chambers of the soul to find in it all, to discover in it the entire world and the entire Torah, end quote, the external cannot be abandoned altogether in that it reinforces the subjective ideal with the sturdiness and strength it needs to endure. Okay. So now what I wanted to... That was my introduction to a paper I'm writing on this engagement to Rambam. In the last 10 years, I don't know if you spoke about it, Rabbi, but we have a tremendous boon in the study of Rav Kook, and that is what I'm holding here. That is Shmona Kvatzim. Many people are not familiar with this, and there's reason for that. When Rav Kook wrote originally... This is very consistent with the way I've described him here. He didn't set out, now I'm not saying he wrote a few treatises. He did write some books. But generally, many of the orot that you might be familiar with were not written as books. They were written on a daily basis as a kind of spiritual diary. So Rav Kook would write in a diary whatever he felt. The intense love that he had for the world, for God, the spirituality just kind of overflowed and ended up through his pen on paper. So there was no systematic kind of book that was composed. The orots, many of the orots, the Orot HaTorah, Orot HaKodesh, were edited by his beloved disciples, primarily the Nazir, David Cohen, they called him the Nazir because he was a Nazir, and Rav Charlap, and his primarily... David Cohen and his son, Tzvi Yehuda. So what we have up until 10 years ago are really Rav Kook's writings channeled through his students, which is not the same as Rav Kook's writings. So they're edited. They're edited thematically, so they'll, let's say, cull all his, from that spiritual diary on a certain topic, and then call it Orot, whatever it is, Orot HaTshuva, Orot HaKodesh. But that's not the way he wrote. We always want to see the way a person wrote. And so not only is it a product of editing, so the meaning changes, but it also is a product of censorship. So that we know now, because we can compare to the actual original and some of the Orots that the Nazir edited, and some things were censored. Some things were censored. They didn't feel the world was ready for it. They didn't feel it reflected well on him. They didn't agree with it. I don't know. That's always the problem with a Talmud. And in fact, this is a problem with having many Talmidim. The more great a thinker is, the more prone he is to being distorted. Which I think is happening today in many areas, primarily in Israel. So when I started to work on this, I would go to the library and take out, they've got it in the library in University of Toronto, and I tried to get it. This is what I mean by being not familiar with it. You can't get it. There wasn't a real publisher at the beginning, like no publisher that I knew of. I tried every publisher. No publisher could get it for me. Right? Finally, I didn't realize. I look at the beginning of the book, and I see a phone number.
there's a phone number, an Israeli phone number. And I say, wait, you know, after a couple of months, I keep on taking the books out, giving them back in, returning them. And I phone the phone number. A woman answers, and I go, hey, do you know anything about this? Oh, yeah, Zebani. You know, it's my son. He went to the Gush. He sells them privately. So I said, can you please, I want to, so sure, let's, so I got it from her. That's the way you get it. And there's many reasons for it. There wasn't a lot of happiness in inner Rav Kook circles about this. But now we have this. And what's even maybe as important is you can date this. That is, we know the dates of these, so you can follow the evolution of his thought. So his thought is, of course, compounded as it is in any person by an evolution in thought. And that happens with every great thinker, right? I often laugh when I hear Stira in the Rambam. Could be that a person, when he writes something when he's 20 years old, and a person, isn't it possible, and that when he writes something when he's 20 and he writes something when he's 50, he may have become more sophisticated, maybe more learned, maybe even changed his mind. Possible. But, you know, people treat these corpuses as monolithic, and then you have spheres within. It's clear that the Rambam changed his mind constantly throughout his life, as we would expect any human being to do so. I don't expect myself to hold the same opinions or to write the same as I did when I was 18. I wouldn't actually like that. So that is a boon to Rav Kook's study. And what I want to get into in the last little bit of my lecture is this notion of something that lies beyond halacha, something that beyond that is meta-halachic, that is that halacha is not sufficient to satisfy the spiritual soul. Let me read something to you from Shmuel Kavatzim, which is also in one of his other writings. Mashahu mugdar harehu chulin legabe hakodesh halyon asher oto anochi mevakesh cholat ahava ani ma kashe li halimud ma kashe alai haistaglut ela pratim. Translation. All that is clearly defined, systematic, halacha, what's mutter, what's usser, right? Clear boundaries, is profane in relation to the supernal holiness that I yearn for. Ki cholat avani, this is Shir HaShirim, for I am sick with love. How difficult is study for me? How difficult it is to accommodate oneself to pratim. They bog him down. He constantly talks about, this is one of many, he constantly talks about how he gets bogged down in particulars because it takes him away from the expansiveness of life, from what he sees as the source of all being that unifies all. Because when you get down to pratim, it actually is anathema to his ultimate view of the universe, because pratim, particulars, you can do this, you can do that, you can't do this, you can't do that, tends to separate, tends to set boundaries, tends to individuate. Halacha is also catered towards individuals. It treats people as individuals. But it is anathema to his ultimate vision of the world that sees the entire world as one unified whole, up somewhere in a very high level, where all differences, they call this ichud hafachim, that is, this is very prominent in Lubavitch thought, though I think, and here we get into a bit of a dangerous territory, that is the difference, borders on pantheism, that is the idea that everything is God, which I think is a dangerous, which the Rambam spent his, I think, much of his life trying to hold back because he saw that things were moving that way. He is generally ascribed to a school of thought that is called panentheism, which is a modified form of pantheism that sees God penetrating everything, but still God is separate somehow. But at a certain point, all nigudim, all stirot, all opposites collapse in a unity. That is, we see things as opposites. We see conflicts. We see great writers, great thinkers in our tradition as competing with each other, or bar pluktos. The Rambam and the Ramban, let's say, the two classic Rishonim, that couldn't have held two more antithetical models. That is, I would say, quite literally, I wouldn't say this actually as a guzma, as an exaggeration, two entirely different religions. That is, I don't mean to say here conduct. Halacha in some ways is something that binds us all in some common system. But their notions of what counts in the world, that is, notions of God, notions of the unity of God, notions of hashkacha, of miracles, of creation, everything that I think is what actually counts ultimately, they diverge from each other, not just kind of nuanced, but were very, very polar opposites, stood in two different domains. They actually, I would say, served two different gods. They worshipped two different gods. So Rav Kook, in his notion, says, no, you don't understand. He would tell me, he would maybe throw me out of class. And he would say, you don't understand, because you're just looking at it from a skewed point of view. When you look at it from the whole, you understand that, and here he's influenced by some modern philosophers, kind of this notion, Hegelian notion, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That is, when two bodies of thought clash, there are kernels of truth in each of them, and they clash to form a synthesis. You just don't know how to extract the unified truth from both of them. So when he says cholat ahava ani, it, in order to really understand that, you would have to understand the cholat ahava ani, let's say, of the Rambam. So the Rambam also quotes that as a maxim that would inform one's ultimate relationship with God. But here is his language in Hilchot Tshuva. That is, the ultimate ahava, the ultimate definition of the love of God, and look at the language. Lahavin ulahaskil. Lahavin ulahaskil. Bechachmot utfunot hamodiin. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 already words in the very beginning of this that are all related to knowledge, to intellect, to science. Lahavin, lahaskil, chachmot, tfunot, modiin, lo et kono, kefi koach shiesh ba'adam, according to the capacity that a man has, lahavin ulahasig, again, to understand and comprehend, al pi hadea, by way of reason, al pi hadea, al pi ahava. Ahava is directly proportional to reason, to rationalism, to the intellect. Im ma'at ma'at, vim harbe harbe. A little, a lot. That is, there is a direct one-to-one correspondence between knowledge, reason, science, my understanding of the world. That means quite literally physics, chemistry. If you're around today, you would have to be proficient in all these things in order to know God. Rav Kook takes that cholat ahava ani and he mystifies it. He brings it into line with all thought that exists up until that point, and he raises it to a transcendent point. That is, knowledge itself, as halakha, he says, rational knowledge, philosophy, also bogs you down in details. You have to overcome that. So let me just quote a few excerpts. that kind of translate this notion into his theology, into his mysticism. It is very difficult for me to involve myself in Yenei Halakha. And again, he was very much involved in Halakha. In fact, the last decade of his life in the Jerusalem years was primarily involved. In fact, he was the one who initiated the Encyclopedia Talmudic in a project called Halakha Brura. And Biur Halakha, which was actually the reverse of what the Rambam tried to do. That is, the Rambam tried to divorce all Halakha from the Talmud. That is, we can debate this, but in my opinion, get rid of the Talmud, don't waste your time, and you know, let's get on to bigger and better things. Here I've encompassed everything. It's here for you in the Mishnah Torah. Rav Kook actually reverses the trend by trying to put all Halakhic literature back on the Daf. That is, insert, that was his project, inserts all post-Talmudic halacha back on the Daf. It's actually quite the reverse of the Rambam's project. Chayn b'inyani b'in agada levad. B'inyanei nigla levad u'b'inyanei nistar levad. K'mo kein kashe li lintot barayon b'derech emunah pshuta levad. Or b'derech mechkar v'igayon levad. I can't involve myself in rational, methodical, systematic, philosophical thought, it's too limiting for me. I can't constrain myself to halakha. It's too restrictive. I need to transcend this. I need to take flight. Literally, shata, he uses the same language actually as the Rambam. Again, I'm getting back into my project. When he uses the word shata, he means literally that his soul, because he wants to unite with the whole, with the oneness that grounds all of being, his soul needs to take flight beyond all categories of logic, all categories of halakha, in order to get to that point where everything boils down into this one unity. Of course, the Rambam uses the word shata. Again, that's why I say the language is very important, I think. When you have the Rambam explaining or describing Abraham's initial discovery of God. That is, Abraham comes from nowhere, sui generis. He was educated in the U of I, the University of Idolatry. His Masorah was idolatry, right? His parents taught him idolatry. So that Abraham, for him, is the supreme model of, for the Rambam, of the Jew, the perfect Jew. The one who actually doesn't have a Masorah, the one who doesn't have a teaching, who arrives at the truth through his own methodical, systematic thinking, despite everything around him, because that's the only way one can know that something is true. And he begins with Avram Shatta. He kind of roamed in the world, in the heavens. And he understood, he extrapolated from the heavens an argument for the existence of one God. But what the Rambam means by shata is not to transcend all rational thought. What the Rambam means is to stick to rational, demonstrative, logical thought until you reach a point where you can prove, they thought, at least the medievals thought, you can prove the existence of God. I think we no longer think that. So what I wanted to get to here, and there are many, 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 many statements of Rav Kook that reflect this tension. Again, his tremendous involvement in halakha, his proficiency in the halakhic literature. But yet, he understands and he feels, as every great man, as I think here he does have something very much in common with the Rambam, his communal responsibilities, his political responsibilities, actually are detrimental to his spiritual growth. I think the Rambam thought this as well. We have a letter from the Rambam that explains his Seder Hayom, where he's involved in medicine, and then he's involved in kind of paskening for the community, you know, in a kind of derogatory way. I would say, you know, these guys are coming to me and asking me whether Wrigley's chewing gum is kosher, right? And I gotta I want to, you know, get into Masa Merkava. I want to get into the account of the chariot. And I only have a couple of hours in the day to do this. I can't even sleep at night. So I understand I have a communal responsibility. I understand I have to have my feet planted on the ground. But it is constraining. It represses my spiritual growth. Now, Rav Kook, though, is one of the only people I know that I've come across with that actually translates this notion, this mystical, sublime notion where everything collapses into a unity, into what we will call politics. And here's where there's many misconceptions about Rav Kook. Again, Rav Kook was not a liberal, was not a pluralist. He didn't think that what you do is okay and what I do is okay. His politics, what got him into so much trouble, was a direct result of this theology. This theology of the unification of opposites. When he said, which got him into, which kind of was his final straw that broke the camel's back with the Haredi, with the old Yeshuv, when Orot, actually, the original Orot was published, actually during his lifetime, and it said, the hitamlut, the exercise of the chalutzim, is more kodesh than all you guys who are sitting in the base of Medrash all day long. Got him into a lot of hot water. They said, you know what, we can't take this anymore. And I don't buy Rav Sonnenfeld, who was the chief representative of the Yeshuv Yahayashan, the old Yeshuv, the Haredim, and Rav Kook, that they were, you know, antagonists in thought, in theology, but they were good friends. I don't buy it. They hated each other, actually. And in fact, now we know from censored versions that Rav Kook says to his son, Rav Sonnenfeld, even when he's nice to me, it's with rishus. So we know that he suffered tremendously. If one reads the Pashkvilim, those posters that still go up every day on walls, those nothing new. I believe with the Gedolim's backing, they called him Oysoya Ish. I don't even want to actually mention the names that they called him, and he suffered tremendously from this. But what they didn't understand, and what I think many people don't understand, is that the politics was not politics. This was a direct result, a translation of his theology, where these chalutzim aren't being mechal, they are being mechal Shabbos. They are secular. They're not learning all day. But the only reason you see them as them and us as us is because you don't understand where this is coming from in the ultimate levels of being. In the ultimate levels of being, in the highest Svirot, actually he says this sometimes, this exercise, the physical exercise of the chalutzim that they do, that they perform on the kibbutz every morning, actually comes from a higher sphera than you guys in the Beis Medrash. The more, in a sense, it's paradoxical, the more external the tumah is, the more holy it is internally. But I want to make it clear that it's not simply politics. It's not simply politics. It's a direct translation of his mystical, theological, philosophical thought that sees everything coalescing into this ultimate unity. Let me just, before I come to the end, because I think I kept you guessing about the title of my lecture, Dancing with the Chalutzim. I haven't approached that yet, but I want to kind of channel all what I said into this Dancing with the Chalutzim. But one more thing. I've been involved in this project that I have, particularly, not many people, I haven't actually found anybody that has actually written on it. He actually has a fragmentary commentary on Sefer Hamadah, the first section of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, called Orot HaRambam. people refer to it here and there, but I don't know if anybody's done a systematic study of it. Maybe in Hebrew there's so much, there's such a voluminous body of literature in Hebrew. Not so much in English, but in Hebrew and Israel, as you would expect. There's an incredible amount of literature. I just want to bring you one comment to show you how he Cookianizes the Rambam. When the Rambam in Hilchos Talmud Torah, a very simple halacha, he talks about pedagogy. And he talks about the gradual, kind of progressive way you would teach young people, children, and then kind of get more and more sophisticated as they grow older, as you would expect. And he says that with a child, you know, you teach them Shema Yisrael right first. Then v'achakach melamdo ma'at ma'at psukim psukim. You teach them kind of psukim here and there. Verses. So this is what Rav Cook's comment on that is. And I personally don't think this is what the Rambam meant, but you'll get an idea of his commentary here. Is of course not so much a commentary, but having the Rambam speak Rav Cook. Mishum diyesh, why does he say this? You teach a child little by little, psukim, psukim. Mishum diyesh beit bichinot b'torah. There are two aspects of Torah. O chatuma nitna, v'klapezeh mechuvan haseder. Either it was given, and this is, many of you might know, the two notions in the Gemara, either the Torah was given at one time, one shot, or megilot nitnu, right? Or they were written over the course of time in a kind of not one unified edition, but over the course of years in the Midbar. And here brings together, crystallizes many of the things in an actual comment, many of the kind of notions that I try to convey here with Rav Cook. So there's that aspect. So he puts the two together. It's a machloket, of course, but he puts the two together because for him, it's all one, right? This is all one. There isn't a machloket. It's a machloket for you who have a skewed view, a distorted view, but at the end of the day, elu ve'elu devrelikim chayim. So that's that the Torah was given in one shot. That's the narrative flow, the logic, the kind of methodical, systematic kind of perception of the world that I'm talking about. Oh, Megillah, Megillah, Nitna. Ve'ein la Seder. Or it was given, Megillot, Megillot, in kind of a haphazard way. And there is no Seder. There is no logical order. Ein Mukdam u'Mechar b'Torah. Actually, the narrative, according to many people, not according to all, doesn't follow a narrative flow. Some things happen in the narrative flow, not chronologically, but some things happen in the narrative later, and they actually historically happened before. So there is no Seder. Al-Kain, he says, Legabe Tinokot. When you teach Tinokot, this is what the Rambam is saying, he says. Bahatchala Olim. At the beginning, we actually teach them the very highest aspect of Torah. The non-logical, the non-systematic, the haphazard, the one that breaks the boundaries of all prose. That's why Rav Cook writes so poetically. That is, his language is poetic, but it's poetic systematically. It's poetic because that's the way I will break through to the ultimate oneness in the world. You teach children Mashalamala Meha Seder. What is beyond organized, systematic thought? Umashrishim Bahem Hatzar Elyon. You inculcate in them. That's exactly with infants, because you ingrain in them at the very start the very highest notion of Torah, which is not the narrative, which is not the strict halachic, not the logic, the one that transcends the narrative, the one where my soul can soar to the heavens. That's what you implant. Then, of course, we get screwed up, right? We get older, we get more conservative, we get more crotchety, we get more kind of planted in our ways, and we become constrained. We all like to live with rules. He says, "V'achakach v'oyim melam dimotam keseder." Afterwards, you do teach keseder. Alkein paskina dekotvin megillah megillah lechinok leTalmud. So this very much captures. And I don't think this is what the Rambam is saying, as kind of a scholar or trying to find out what the Rambam really meant. I'm not sure this is what the Rambam really meant. But it does capture the two aspects of Torah, the meta-halachic, meta-narrative, meta-logic, meta-philosophical, and the strict logical, philosophical, systematic that you have here in this comment. And there are many of these comments. So what I'd like to do now is simply end off with the incident that was the title of my lecture, Dancing with the Chalutzim. Because I think here you have a moment that really, really translates into, and this is what I mean, Rav Kook is unusual for me because most of the thinkers that I deal with, I don't see the, if I'm dealing with mysticism, actually translating into politics. Rav Kook was in an unusual position because of his own initiative, that all this thought is translated into actual political social activity that we would call politics. But I don't think Rav Kook would ever call it politics because that would be profane. In 1913, he actually did get together with Rav Sonnenfeld. He was very, very hurt by Shabbos. He just could not, Rav Kook could not accept that people were being mechalel Shabbos. That was one thing he just could not stomach. He saw Shabbos as the essence of Judaism. He actually formed a group that he thought could go to the various kibbutzim of the Yishuv HaChadash and persuade them to come back to Shabbos. And him and Rav Sonnenfeld and a few other Rabbanim actually traveled from kibbutz to kibbutz, moshav to moshav. There was one moshav that they ended up on, actually started by a group of American Jews, totally secular, totally liberal. The kitchen wasn't kosher. They didn't keep Shabbos. It was Friday night. They couldn't eat in the kitchen. They sat outside eating salted fish. All of a sudden, this sound comes from the hall, from the Moshav hall, of dancing and singing. Rav Sonnenfeld and Rav Kook enter into the room. And there's this tremendous spirit, right? The chalutz spirit that we've lost. I hope slowly will be regained. But this spirit of the pioneer spirit and the dancing and the singing. And Rav Sonnenfeld is impressed. And Rav Kook is just inspired to no end. He starts dancing with them. And then him and another of the chalutzim leave the hall. And they come back and Rav Kook is dressed as a chalutz with a rifle. And the chalutz is dressed as Rav Kook. And they're dancing together, right, in this incredible scene. I mean, just something you wish you were at. But the reason I brought this episode at the end of my kind of lecture is simply to show that this cannot simply be reduced to some political act or some act of kiruv, some kind of trivial act of kiruv. Yeah, you know what? I'll join them and that way I'll suck them into my way of thought. Rav Sonnenfeld may have been part of that group in that sense. That is, you know what? I'm here. They're there. I got to bring them here. Look at what happened. This is the achdut, the unity of opposites, translated into an actual event. This is not some haphazard, I'm so happy, I'll dance with you, you're a chalutz, I'm a rabbi, we'll just change clothes and we'll, you know, hunky-dory. It's not that at all. This is all his thought translated into this moment where we can actually change clothes because we are in the ultimate svirot of the world, one. Me, the Rav Rashi, actually he wasn't the Rav Rashi yet, but me, I think he did conduct himself as a Hasidic Rebbe, and you are really in the ultimate supernal world, one. You, Rav Sonnenfeld, or you, Harim, don't understand that. I'm not trying to be Makar of this guy. I mean, there is some of that, obviously. He doesn't want him to be Makar of Shabbos. But this act of changing clothes is a literal concretization of all his thought. I'll end with that. And I'll just end with one quote of his was related to Slichus, because since we just started Slichus, where he sees slicha as, again, not just simply individual forgiveness, not just praying for individual forgiveness, not just doing tshuva for my chatoim, but he sees it as part of redemption of the entire world. Again, that's the way he saw things. His love for the entire universe, for everybody, for all nations, exceeded all bounds. And in that little lecture that he gave on Slichot, he talked about the return of Israel to, return of Jews to Israel, which is part of this redemptive, universal redemptive process. Shifat Yisrael Binyan Ha'uma. The aspirations, the pursuit of the Jews to rebuild their nation, L'Shivat Ha'aretz, to return to the world, to their land. Hishifa shel omek hatov hachoder et kol hayesh bishorsho. It is the pursuit of the very depths of the goodness that penetrates all of being at its core. This is not simply, again, this is transcends his own Jewish thing to a universal thing. That is, the return of the Jews to Israel wasn't simply a manifestation of their own nationalism, of their own coming home, but viewing Israel as, in terms of the world, the soul of the world, their return to their land returns all of being to its very core goodness. Lo zkifat levena me'ez binyan, it's not just planting a brick in some house. Ki im pniyah shleima v'amuka el hayisod shel kol habinyan. It is the very grounding and underpinning of the entire building. And that is what slichot should ultimately be directed towards. The redemption not of yourself, not of just Israel, which of course it includes, but of the entire world. So I hope I've kind of given you a taste of Rav Kook's thought on this issue. And I don't know if there's time for some questions. Okay. Shana Tova.